Get ready to start our Bible classes here at 36th Street. We welcome everyone this morning, all those here especially, those online that can view us. We appreciate you being with us today. So let's go to God in prayer as we open our class, please. Our precious Heavenly Father, we come before you this morning praising your name. We thank you so much for all the blessings you've given us. We thank you for the beauties of this day, for the wonderful opportunities you've given us in our lifetime and all the blessings that you've always poured out to us. We ask you to be with us this morning as we open your words. We look back at through your Old Testament of the stories and of all the rich history that you gave us in your word to show us your love and your commitment to mankind throughout the entire era, that everything that's happened was for a reason, that you've had your hand in all things, and that as we look forward to our lives, we can expect the same thing, that you are in control and you have us in your heart and in your hands. Be with all of us, be with this congregation, be with all those that are suffering this morning, those that are going through different ailments and different problems. Help them and keep them safe. We ask this now in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so we're picking up in Genesis chapter 41. Before I go much further, happy Father's Day for all you fathers out there. I was telling Doug, I realized that first time I taught class in how many years was on Mother's Day. Now I get to take Father's Day for my second class. So it's, I think there's a, maybe I get the holidays when everybody's out of town, that makes saves them. But no. If you're missing Terry Garner this morning, he did make it down to Tennessee, and he's worshiping down there this morning, so, and on his way to Oklahoma. Heading for a grandson's wedding, I believe, in July. So, is there any announcements or anything we need to bring up before the class, before we start? Okay, no, we'll open our verse then. Suppose that we're supposed to start with verse 38. I like the verse 37. This proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. What proposal are we talking about? Remember last Sunday with Tim teaching, we had the story of Pharaoh having the visions, having the dreams of the cows, the fat cows and the skinny cows eating the fat cows, and then the grain, one with seven heads of wheat on it, full and plentiful, and then another one that was scrawny and weak, and it ate the or consumed the full heads, and all his wise men of Egypt couldn't answer his question of what did these things mean. And we get to our subject matter of Joseph. Where is Joseph? He's still in jail. It's been 2 years. He's been in jail from his experiences and everything else going on, and the cupbearer, who he already explained the dream for, remembers, hey, there was a kid when I was in jail that knew my dreams, told Pharaoh about it, and says, here's a man, here's this Hebrew that can interpret dreams. So Pharaoh called him out. Joseph stands before Pharaoh and explains the dreams, what that means. You're going to have 7 years of plentiful, and then we're going to have 7 years of famine. And not only did he explain the dreams, then he said, here's what you need to do. Here's what my God is telling you to do. Get somebody that knows what they're talking about, that can handle and do management, to store up the 7 years of plenty, take a fifth or 20% of all the grains for those 7 years each year and store them away, and then you'll have plenty for the lean years, for the famine coming. And this proposal pleased Pharaoh and his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this, in whom is the Spirit of God?" You know, you think of Pharaoh, in their minds, the all-powerful, godlike ruler, supposed to know everything. And he's asking them, "Where can we find somebody that can do this? Do we have anybody like this?" Yeah, he was considered a god, right? But Pharaoh understands inside of Joseph is in whom is the Spirit of God. Did he have a full concept of a Hebrew God? I don't think so. Their concept of a singular God was not there 100%. They had a main God, but not the God concept. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you are." Since God showed it to you, nobody else can discern it except for you. And remember, this is the ultimate empire of the world of the day. You know, Egypt was all powerful. It had all the control. It had all the might. And here is the top man in Egypt saying, "Nobody's wiser than you, Joseph." And who is Joseph to this Pharaoh? Some kid pulled out of jail, a Hebrew, a foreigner, standing before him, and all at once is now the most discerning person that Pharaoh knows. That's how much influence, how much power this dream had on Pharaoh. These dreams and this interpretation of those dreams and that vision that Joseph had been able to explain to him. So remember, what did Joseph tell Pharaoh before he told him the dream? "Not me. My God is going to tell you what it is. My God will handle your problem." So, that's back in verse 28. And Joseph said to Pharaoh, "The dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. Because you dreamed it twice, it's going to happen. It's certain to happen, and it's going to happen soon. Get ready." So, here's Joseph. Remember when he was in jail, it's been 2 years since he interpreted the dreams for the cupbearer and the baker. 2 years he's been wallowing in jail, but what's he been doing while he's in jail? He's head of the prison. He's head of the jail. You know, the jailer's job is 100% easier because Joseph's doing everything. And why is he in jail? Because he was tricked by Potiphar's wife. And what was he doing while he was at Potiphar's? When Potiphar bought him from into slavery, bought him from these slave traders, basically, what was he doing in Potiphar's house? He was controlling everything Potiphar owned. And in Joseph's own words, he says, "I have control of everything except for Potiphar's wife." And who was Joseph before that? Some arrogant kid up in Israel, or what will be Israel, bugging his 11 brothers about how great he's going to be. The arrogance of the younger brothers. Okay. Do we see God raising Joseph up step by step by step here? Okay, we'll find out. It's been about 13 years since he was sold into slavery by his brothers until he's now serving Pharaoh. Is that an invite? Yeah. You got to ride in the front of the car, front seat instead of the back seat? Okay.
Took a couple of fellows with me because there was a young man in the community where we were living that he and his brother had both held up two or three banks the same Saturday, and they both had good jobs, good paid jobs. What motivated them to do that, nobody ever knew. But they put him in a penitentiary. Asked me if I would go visit. Well, it's a little intimidating to do that. But at the same time, I said yes. And so I went to the penitentiary. They said, when I went, they said, now, don't be surprised if he has risen to the top. He may be a big shot at the prison by now. So sure enough, when I went into the prison to visit with him, I left my friends went out in the lobby. I went into the prison. And he was, the first time I saw him, he had a referee's whistle around his neck and a clipboard under his arm. So I think they told me the truth. This guy had come to the top already. So, you know, I say that simply to show that this is reality. This isn't a phantasmagoria story. It really happens. It does really happen.
Now, people like that, you know, that just have that attitude or that personality type that takes over or is a leader or is, you know, not afraid to step up and, help others. And I think that's part of the story of why that's all is in the Bible for us. Not just, you know, great stories, you know, not just great campfire stories like the kids are learning upstairs, you know, during our Sunday morning VBSs. And this is a story, how many times have we heard this story in your lifetimes? I know. But it's the reminder that God, in control, can do anything, and he will use anyone. He can use anyone, no matter how weak we feel, no matter how insignificant we can feel, no matter how being ready to be in control type thing, that God can use us still. So we read through this. Let's go on. Again, starting with verse 39, then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has shown you all this, there is nothing so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. And then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, clothed him in garments of fine linen, put a gold chain around his neck, made him ride in his second chariot, and they called out before him, bow the knee. Then he set him over all the land of Egypt. One day you're in jail, next day you're in command. Wow.
somebody that much power? Because you worry about coups. If all of his servants were also on board with the plan, that also meant Potiphar. So Potiphar might have spoken about, you know, how Joseph conducted himself, and maybe the prison guard, how he conducted himself there in prison. And maybe Pharaoh could take the chance on putting Joseph in that position because he knew that Joseph wasn't going to overthrow him.
Maybe he didn't fear him as much.
Or, like I said, the other side of it is these dreams scared Pharaoh. I mean, he woke up and immediately demanded somebody tell him what this meant. It really bothered him. He was perplexed by what he dreamt. You know, sounds kind of weird, cows and grain eating each other, but that concept really hit home for him for some reason. He knew it was important. So, and then to have a young man come up out of jail and just tell him, even when all of his magicians, all his wise men, all his priests, all his, the greatness of the knowledge of Egypt. Remember, this wasn't a dumb society. The libraries of Alexandria and stuff we have from things that are kept from way back, they were a society that was ahead of basically everybody else in the area, anywhere. Remember when Joseph came out of prison, what did he have to do first? They drug him out in chains and threw him in front of Pharaoh, right? No. He had to get up, he had to bathe, he had to shave, he had to put on linen clothes. Why is that significant? Anybody remember your ancient Egypt history? What were they known for? Cleanliness. Facial hair was looked down on. It was disgusting to them. They shaved. Were the shepherds up in Hebron worried about facial hair? No. Nah. You know, they were living out with the sheep all the time. They were herdsmen. They followed the animals around. They lived out in the country where they'd have to dig their own wells. They wore, more than likely, woolen or whatever material they could manufacture from skins, from whatever is available. They were rough. They were the outdoorsmen of the day, you know. Egyptians were refined. They wore linen, cotton clothing. They were clean. They bathed regularly. They shaved. So they had to make Joseph presentable for Pharaoh. They took him out of prison and cleaned him up. Pharaoh sets him up and says, "You are in control."
Doug, can we see the analogy between God and the Pharaoh? God has given into our hands his work here on earth. I think that shows a lot of the same attitude.
So, but yeah, exactly. You know, what condition were we in when we came to Christ? You know, in reality, in that thinking, we were sinners. We weren't clean. We weren't ready. We weren't prepared. But through the baptism and through the washing of through the blood of Jesus, we are prepared. We are redeemed. We are cleansed and presentable. So he gets clothes, he gets a signet ring. Remember what the signet ring represents? That was the power. Anything that was written down, and remember, Egyptians wrote everything down. That's why we have such a great antiquities of Egypt. They wrote everything down, and the climate there kept it. But the signet ring, anything that was written down was stamped to prove who had that power. And not so he didn't make a signet ring for Joseph for his position. Pharaoh gave Joseph his signet ring, gave him that control. He gave him that authorization, gave him that immediate, you know, it's almost immediate. From the sounding of it, this was the same day. You know, they're standing together still. He gives him clothes. He makes sure he gets dressed properly. He puts him in his second best chariot. I'm sure it was as luxurious as the primary one. It was just Pharaoh had one he liked better than the other. You know, who knows? But it was a sign of position. Not only is he given Joseph the authority, he is making Joseph presentable to the nation that he's not only in control, here is how you will recognize him, that he has control. He's going to become an Egyptian. He's going to become a high-standing authority. He dresses him properly. He, you know, gives him transportation that's his level. He gives him the signet ring to control it, and he gives him a gold chain to put around his neck. Out of the depths of the jail, now he's wearing gold. And they called out before him, "Bow the knee." Another interpretation of that is, "Kiss the ground." Here comes a high official. Here comes Pharaoh, basically. Because who else were they going to bow to besides Pharaoh? Thus he set him over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no one shall lift up his hand or foot in all the land." And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah. I don't know. I can't speak Egyptian. But that's as close as I can come up with it. And from what I researched, I couldn't find anybody that really knew what it meant. They had different interpretations from older Jewish literature about it and talking about this story, but they couldn't find any direct reference anywhere for it. One of the interpretations, though, was he who sees dreams, kind of in that concept. Part of the word is a word out of what they could use for God. So they're almost making Joseph a god with this name. And he gave him in marriage Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So he gave him as a wife the daughter of the highest priest of the land. Who was On? The city of On, Onifer, whatever. Heard of the Egyptian god Ra, the sun god. Their number one. He was a priest in this city of Ra, the prophet, the priest was. So he gave him a high priest daughter as a wife to fit him into Egyptian society. So he took, you know, this is Pharaoh, not the priest giving away his daughter. This is Pharaoh giving that lady to Joseph. Yeah.
We know at the end of Jacob's life, he adopts Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And so this foreign lady becomes a matriarch in Israel.
Right.
Yeah.
So
over two tribes.
Yeah. So he becomes important, or she becomes the mother of a good portion of Israel, if you think of it that way, going on. But again, with all the things that Pharaoh's given Joseph, he's setting him up to be accepted by Egyptian society. And not just the people of Egypt, but the elite of Egypt. So it's not, you know, How many of we have worked at times different places where they brought somebody in to take over the department or the branch or whatever that you've never heard of before? And you're saying, what do they have that, you know, there's people here that have been working here for a long time that know everything, that can really has a better understanding of how things work. Why are they bringing this yoko, you know? Oh, no. No. But to find out later that, hey, the person that they put in charge here really does know what they're talking about. Sometimes that works out, sometimes it doesn't. But the ones that do, you know, that they've brought in are basically a ringer that can take over and knows more because of what's outside of our little society and what's inside, you know, that there are other things that affect how things happen. So, but still, you're taking a Hebrew who they're looking down on, this unshaven shepherd, and putting him over all of us. We have to bow our knees to that guy. So Pharaoh's doing everything he can to make Joseph acceptable. Not only because I said so, but because he has all these things now. He has an in with the families through this priest. So Joseph went out over the land of Egypt. If you remember your geography of Egypt, it's a pretty good-sized place. It's basically the Nile River up into the mountains, the Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt. But the Nile is what keeps them in production, where their profits come from. Everything in Egypt is associated with the Nile River. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. So, 30 years old. When's the last time we heard of a date or an age for Joseph? Remember? Chapter 37, yes. He was 17 years old when he was sent out and told on his brothers. And we think, you know, within that time period, he was told on his brothers, they got in trouble, he got his coat. The brothers then went back out, and Joseph went back out to them. They captured him that time, threw him in a pit, and sold him instead of killing him. So this 12, 13, 14-year time span, Joseph's grown up quite a bit. How much of a thought process or a development growth did you have between the time you were 17 and the time you were 30? You know, some of us were still struggling, me, but, you know, the 17-year-old attitude of I can do anything, there's nothing I can't do, everything is going to work out my way. You know, I've got these great dreams. You hit 30, most of us at that time were, well, from our generation, by the time you were 30, you had your kids, you were struggling to make a house payment, you were struggling to keep a job, you were struggling to make enough money to feed everybody you were responsible for. Things didn't look quite as rosy at 30 as they did at 17, right? So here's Joseph in that same position. He left his dad's house one day to go check on his brothers, wound up being a slave, being sold into Egypt, spending years with Potiphar, we don't know how many. He was in jail for at least 2 years, probably more, because he'd already been there long enough to take over before the baker showed up, and it was 2 years after that, so he may have been in there 4 or 5 years. We don't know. But still, in these 12 years, the ups and downs that Joseph went through, and we think our life was bad, You know, we had some struggles, we had some problems. Yep, we all did. But he was 30 years old, which seems to be the kind of the magic age throughout the Bible, isn't it? I know in Jewish customs, you weren't really a man until you were 30. You weren't able to take any responsibilities. You couldn't be, you know, you weren't expected to be part of upper society until you were at least 30. Jesus was 30, you know. So there's that number is another number that kind of floats through the entire Bible. If you want one of those studies to find certain things, there's another one you can look at. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all the land of Egypt. He wore out his chariot. He went to see. Remember, what did Joseph know about Egypt? He knew the prison pretty well. He knew the area where Potiphar lived, probably somewhat. But the entire region of, in the whole area of Egypt? So he spent some time doing his homework. He went out to see how things worked, why things worked, where things were located, you know, what they had in place, what was available, what blessings they already had that they weren't even realizing they had. Getting prepared for what God said was going to happen. So how did Egypt survive? We knew they raised cotton. We know they had grain, but why? What was the number one thing, remember from your history lessons about Egypt? What happens every year? The Nile floods. The Nile comes up, it washes all the nutrients out of the mountains, it comes down just like the Ohio Valley. The river comes up every spring, it floods all the fields, it makes a mess, there's mud everywhere, but what happens in the summer? We grow the best corn around. Reedsville corn is known area-wide, right? Nationwide almost. It was for years and years and years. The Mississippi River does the same thing. Look at the delta of Mississippi's and Louisiana's and all the cotton and stuff that was grown there. It's the nature of things, but their agriculture, their nation depended upon the Nile River. They had their transportation, they could float all the resources down the river, ship it worldwide at the time. So for those 7 years, the Nile flooded. And it says it produced enough. Think of that. He said, what was the percentage Joseph suggested to Pharaoh? 20%. Take one-fifth. Now, wait a minute. We're going to have 7 years of famine or feast and 7 years of famine, and we're only going to take 20% a year? And in 7 years, that's 1 year, 1.5 years worth of grain, you would think, right? How plentiful was the 7 years to be able to take 20% of it, store it away, and feed for 7 years? That concept, though, why would you not take more than if you were going to get that much extra and you only take 20%? The abundance of those 7 years is just unfathomable. If it was twice as much as normal, if it was, you know, 10 times as much as normal, we don't know. But they live fat on the land for 7 years. But what happens at the end of 7 years? They've got them stored. They said that they've gathered so much that they couldn't hold anymore, and they quit counting it because it couldn't be counted. There was so much. 20% couldn't be counted for. And he made those granaries or that storage bins. And, you know, you got all kinds of different theories of how they did that, you know, but this is Egypt. It's dry in those areas away from the Nile. As soon as you get outside of Nile, it's fairly dry. It's things kept forever. One of the funny things I read was the first European visitors, probably during the Crusades, went to Egypt, saw pyramids. And what did they call them? Joseph's silos. That's what those were for. That's where Joseph stored the grain, in those pyramids. Well, that's not quite right, because they got looking at them and said, hey, these things are solid stone. There's this one little chamber that goes down to nowhere. You know, it can't be them. But they, like Doug said, they have found pits. Basically, they dug down and lined huge cavernous silos in the ground. Because where's the safest place? Down deep. It's self-contained, it's dry, it keeps everybody from seeing as much of it as possible. And it was at every city, not just one location. All up and down the Nile River and all the major cities, there were these huge silos full of grain waiting for them. Let's continue reading. He went out to the presence of all the land. During this 7 plentiful years, earth produced abundantly, and he gathered up all the food of those 7 years which occurred in the land of Egypt and put the food in the cities. He put in every city the food from the fields around it. Joseph stored up grain in great abundance, like the sand of the sea, until he ceased to measure it, for it could not be measured. How much sand is in the sand of the sea? Yeah, at the beach. Before the year of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph. Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On, bore them to him. Joseph called the names of the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's and all my father's house. The name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my afflictions. Okay. So we have, as usual, the names have a meaning. You don't name your child in the Old Testament without it having a full meaning. So he understands, he remembers that God is still in control in all this. He still gives God the glory for everything. The 7 years of plenty that occurred in the land of Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come. And Joseph had said, there was famine, and as Joseph had said, there was famine in all the land, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. When all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread, and Pharaoh said to the Egyptians, go to Joseph, what he says to you, do. Yeah, he could have told us, yeah, I know what you do. But no, he still has Joseph. He's still relying on Joseph. The guy in charge that knows what's going to happen, that knows what's going to do, how to do it, the guy that set it all up, ask him. So when the famine had spread over all the land, Joseph opened up the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. You ever think of that? Here they were taxed 20% of everything they raised just to have it sold back to you. Joseph is making money for Egypt. I mean, that, no wonder the Pharaoh lets him in charge. He's a moneymaker. He can control and he manages well. But why didn't he just give the grain away? Somebody has to pay for it eventually, right? So, but that's...
Possessions and the people actually belong to Pharaoh. They sell
right.
Including themselves.
Right. So he sold it back to the Egyptians, but also when all the land of Egypt was famished. So when the famine had spread, Joseph opened the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. Moreover, all the earth came to Egypt to Joseph to buy grain, because the famine was severe over all the earth. What normally causes famine? Lack of water, drought. When the rain quits, the rivers don't rise. When the rivers don't rise, the land gets depleted. If the Nile's not flooding, and there's historical accounts of in ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics, that talks about it. They know that this happened because they recorded it. The river didn't flood for 7 years, and they were in desperate need because of it, except because of the storehouses that Joseph had made. They survived, and the world survived, because Egypt was shipping this grain all over the world at the time. How else would next class, the people, Joseph's family, know to go to Egypt? Now, Egypt quit shipping it during those 7 years of famine because they made everybody come to them. As we look at this, though, and these, this portion of the story, this portion of history, this portion of God's Word, I think sometimes we hear the word story. We talk about biblical stories, and it's almost like fables. But this isn't a fable. This is real life. This happened. And we have to believe that, because if we don't believe what Genesis says, none of the rest of the book matters. The old story is, if you can't believe Genesis 1:1, you might as well just quit reading. If you refuse to believe Genesis 1:1, then nothing else is relevant. But if you don't read all of it, you can't believe Genesis 1:1. Because of over and over and over and over, we're told and we're shown and we're given proof of God's control and His love and His willingness to accept us and what He's done for us. So it kind of goes hand in hand. The more we read the Bible, the more Genesis 1:1 means to us. What's this story they really give to us, though? How many times have we had those prosperous years when everything seems to go right and everything's doing good and everybody's healthy and happy and everybody's doing what we want, and we don't really have too many concerns, but then all at once our health goes, or there's a family problem, or there's an economic problem, or there's something else that happens in our lives that just stops us cold. How do we handle that? How do we recover from that? How do we deal with what life throws at us, what the world tries to force on us? War, famine, everything that happens in our lives. And the older we get, the more often that's happened, correct? When we were young and it happened the first time, it was, what are we going to do now? And we heard our grandparents saying, well, back in my day, and we're saying, no, that was a long time ago, that doesn't matter, Well, now we're the grandparents, and we can tell those young people, back in our day, we saw this happen. Back in Joseph's days, it happened. To keep reminding us, don't give up. Keep continuing on. Recover. God is in control. And that's our whole reason to keep studying and to believe, is God is in control. If He's not, we don't have that hope. If all we're relying on is my ability to recover from this, I'm not that powerful. Are you? when we say, I can get over whatever ailment's happening, I'm going to take care of it. Whatever economic problem, I'm going to take care of it. I got to quit doing this because I don't have time to go to church because I got to take care of this problem. Well, wait a minute. Are we putting the cart before the horse? Or the chariot before the horse in this matter? We can't give up because we can't control it, because we'll never control it.